community radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's edition of Interchange. I'm Helen Harrell, and I'm very excited about my guest tonight, one of the more interesting people that I have ever talked to, seriously. His name is Garth Pollack, and he's a member of the Baha'i community, but he's that and so much more. Welcome to Interchange, Garth. Before we start talking about the Baha'i faith and some of the things that are going on, some of the hostilities in the world and some of the things that Baha'is have actually faced over the centuries, let's talk a little bit about you. You are not a native Bloomingtonian. How long have you been here?
12 years ago, we started coming because my wife's parents moved here. And we were living in Africa at the time. And so when we'd come back for home visits, we started to get to know Bloomington. And so when we found that we needed to come back to the United States, we landed in Bloomington and are very happy to be here.
Well, I think we're very happy to have you here, too. Now, you weren't raised where? California? Is that what you're
That's right.
Me?
I was born in California and lived there till I was 21. I encountered the Baha'i faith as a high school student. I was looking for way of serving humanity and tried local politics and helping one of the local candidates and kind of became disillusioned with the process. This is still in high school. And decided I'd start volunteering for a non-government organization, which was called the Freedom from Hunger Foundation, and became quite involved locally. And during a United Nations festival that was held every year in our county, we had our booth there promoting our activities. And the last evening, I went out to see what else was happening and encountered the Baha'is there and was a bit surprised to see how a religion could be involved with the United Nations. And so it piqued my interest, and I began investigating at that point.
That is intriguing. How were they involved with the United Nations at that time? This would have been what, in the 1960s, 70s?
This was 1969.
69,
yeah.
Okay.
The Baha'is have an office at the United Nations and are part of the religious community. The different religions are represented at the United Nations and help in developing policies from different religious backgrounds. So, and we sit on committees for environment, for religious unity, for the advancement of women, for child rights. So we sit on a number of the standing committees for these areas. But locally, the Baha'i principles lend themselves very much to the United Nations. We believe that there should be world peace. We believe that all humanity should treat each other as brothers and sisters, and that religions should actually find their diversity something that is enchanting rather than dividing. And we also believe very much in the advancement of women equally with men. So all of these principles line up very much with what the United Nations promotes.
And I can see where some of them might create some conflict with some of the other dominant religions in the more dominant, more prevalent, I guess. We don't hear as much about the Baha'i as we do, you know, Islam, for instance, or certainly Christianity and Judaism. They seem to be more in the forefront. But didn't Baha'i kind of grow out of?
That's right. The Baha'i faith started approximately 165 years ago in what was then Persia and is now Iran. And, excuse me, the founder of the Baha'i faith began promoting some of these principles about the advancement of women, the equality of all people, and it was seen as a fulfillment of Islam and Christianity, but the religious leaders didn't see that, and so Baha'u'llah, who was the founder of the Baha'i faith, was persecuted and put in prison and banished and basically spent the rest of his life either in prison or under house arrest, which was 40 years.
Okay. That seems to happen to so many people when they step forward and try to actually carry out, I think, some of the tenets of what the philosophy that's being purported. Okay, you went from California. Now, I know you've lived in South America and you've lived in Africa. What took you to those countries? What did you do in those countries?
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. When I went to South America, I went to Bolivia. I was only planning to stay for the summer, but found myself so enchanted with the people and the culture and the country that I found I would be able to continue my education there and decided to stay. I was able to turn in my ticket, and I was able to, in those days, it was easier to turn in return tickets. But with the $400, my return ticket, I was able to start a language school with a Bolivian partner, and was able to sustain myself for my first year there off those $400. From there, I was asked to teach at the university. And Baha'is, when they live overseas, you could call them missionaries, but we don't really serve in the same way. We find our own jobs, we maintain ourselves, and we just live in the local Baha'i community alongside of, and just the same as everyone else. So the activities we had was beginning to promote community development in the rural areas, working with rural school teachers. And in Bolivia, we started a university that focused on rural development and a number of different initiatives in public health and local governance and in distance education.
Now, when you went to South America, did you go by yourself or did you go with a group?
Yeah, I went with a group of youth. I was 21 at the time. And again, it was supposed to be a six-week trip and get to see the country, visit the Baha'i communities there. And it was interesting. About half of us ended up staying for some period of time. And each found our own way in order to stay.
I think you were telling me before you actually did radio.
Yeah. At one point, the Baha'i community on the Altiplano area between La Paz and Oruro, we started a local community radio station, and that's at about 13,000 feet. It's very cold, almost all year long. It's cold and colder, but it was a community-based radio, and we were working with Aymara and Quechua Indians, and so the broadcast would be in three languages, in Spanish, Aymara and Quechua. One of the interesting things I like to share is that we had the lost cow section, and this is one of the big parts of our community radio. Was anything that happened in the community, the people were allowed, encouraged to bring their announcements and anything they wanted to share with the community. So oftentimes you'd hear about a brown cow that had wandered off from one community, and if anybody'd seen it, please let Radio Baha'i know, and they'd get the message out to the community.
That sounds like fun. It does sound like it was really, it would bring the community together. Now, having a radio station that was a Baha'i-run radio station, was it religious at all or faith-based in content?
Yes. Well, the Baha'is, we have certain principles that we promote throughout every activity, but they're very universal. And so on the one hand, they could sound faith-based, but on the other hand, they're universal. So one is that there should be world peace, that there should be no differences between people due to nationality, race, religion, gender, social class, that science and religion should find a point of harmony in serving humanity, the equality of men and women. All of these principles were promoted through the radio. But we also served the activities in the region for the Baha'i communities.
Now, what would be one of the big differences, I think, between the Baha'i approach and the typical missionary approach?
Well, possibly the message. The Baha'is are very welcoming of anyone who would like to become a Baha'i, but it's rather through people deciding that's what they want rather than an effort to convince people about it. Baha'is are very engaged in trying to develop community activities to promote education of children, to the advancement of women. For example, one of the principles of the Baha'i faith is if a family only had enough money to educate, if they had two children and one was a son and one was a daughter, if they only had money to educate one of the children, they should educate the daughter. And the reason for that is that she's the first educator of humanity. That she'll be the educator of children, and then that just gives all of humanity a better chance.
I can see right there where that certainly comes in conflict with certain dominant religions in the world right now, that promoting women in that way. I mean, I know that part of my family's Catholic, for instance, and I know that Catholics have been criticized because they do respect, honor, worship, whatever, you know, Mary, and there are certain groups of people who think that's just outrageous. But Okay, let's see. You were in South America.
Mm-hmm.
How long were you in South America? Then you went to Africa?
No, actually, back and forth. Actually, I was in South America for 17 years. And then from South America, I went for what worked out to be a shorter stint in Albania, in the Mediterranean area. I was there for 5 years. And then from Albania, I went to Zambia.
And this was all part of what you were doing with Baha'i, or was part of it just independent? You wanted to travel, or?
They're sort of commingled such that it's hard to separate them. A friend of mine that lived in Bolivia had been doing some leadership training in Albania. He came back to Bolivia and was sharing how exciting it was. And we had done a lot of training together, working with NGOs and helping build their capacity in Bolivia. And he said, well, I'm going back. And I said, boy, I'd love to go with you sometime. And he said, great, I'm going next month. And so I found myself there the next month, and opportunities opened up. And so I ended up moving there 6 months later.
I assume you probably weren't married at this time, were you?
I was still not married. I was a very late bloomer. While I was in Albania, I was asked to begin going to Uganda and help with building a training institute there and helping the staff develop. And the Baha'i World Center, curiously enough, although the Baha'i faith originated in Iran or Persia, Baha'u'llah is finally banished to what is now Israel, what then was Palestine and part of the Turkish Empire. And so I would, on my way from Albania to Africa, stop in Israel, which is the Baha'i World Center, and that's where I met my wife. She was volunteering there. And we met, and she was actually heading off to Zambia to work on early adolescence education program. And we hit it off, and next thing I know, we got married, and we were both off to Zambia.
Zambia. So how long were you at? And you were in several countries in Africa, were you not?
I worked with a number of countries, but we lived the whole time in Zambia, and that was 12 years.
And that's where you've come from directly to the U.S.
Yeah.
And living back here.
It was not by choice. All the other moves I made in my life and changes of direction were very conscious. My wife got very ill, and we kind of exhausted the resources there for finding out what was wrong with her. And so we sent her here to Bloomington for her parents, and we got a rather serious diagnosis. And so our two boys and I, we moved back here in February last year. And I'm happy to say my wife made a very wonderful recovery and is totally cured. And we decided that we wanted to stay a bit longer and make sure that everything was okay. And in that process, we've decided to kind of put down roots here in Bloomington.
And, well, how old are your boys? They probably want to stay.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, they our eldest son, he's 11, and he was born in Africa. And our second son is 8 years old. He was actually born at home here in Bloomington. We were on home leave. And, the birth got ahead of us. So while we were on our way to leave out the door, she says, I don't think we're going to make it. So he was born right at home. And I think a lot of people were quite shocked. But for us, that was practically what happens every day in Africa. So we weren't too worried.
Yeah, I imagine the experience is a little different. What is it like living, say, in South America and Africa and then compared to here? I mean, there have got to be pluses and minuses everywhere.
Everywhere I've lived, there's wonderful things and challenges. And I think what kept me abroad so much were the challenges. Every country has dichotomies. And so in the urban areas, most urban areas anywhere in the world can be like living in the United States, but it's the rural areas that most attracted me in my service. And oftentimes people without electricity, without running water, building the houses out of materials at hand and eking a living out of farming. But what always has impressed me was the sense of community, the ability to work together, of tolerance in the community, and things that I learned a lot from those communities, the sense of unity and what you have to do to maintain unity in a community.
Is it shocking to come back and live in the U.S. again, or has it been an adjustment?
Well, when you add up all the time I've been out of the United States longer than I lived here, but because of coming back to visit family every couple of years, kind of kept up with things. But being back, the complexity is a lot more complex living here than abroad. And I think the thing that strikes me most, and it's still quite a challenge, is a kind of sense of isolation that people have, that their lives are so busy. Also, technology, automobiles keeps us in some ways separated. And that's quite a change. In Africa and Albania and South America, you knew all your neighbors, you were connected to their lives, and it's something we miss and actually are quite excited about trying to work toward here.
It's time to take a station break. You've been listening to Helen Harrell talking with Garth Pollack. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the Baha'i faith itself. And welcome back to Interchange. Thank you for staying with us. I'm Helen Harrell. I'm talking with Garth Pollack, who is a member of the Baha'i community here in Bloomington, sort of a new resident to Bloomington, having lived in South America and Africa. And when we took the station break, we were talking a little bit about community. And I wonder if you could address a little bit, you were talking about the difference between Africa and South America and the sense of community as opposed to here, and how perhaps you can bring your Baha'i beliefs and systems to maybe helping out, creating a little more community, sense of community among people.
Yeah. Well, we found how vitally important it is having those connections, a sense of joy, being connected to community. A lot of sacrifice, too, because people have hard lives, and you're involved in all aspects of people's lives, not just the good stuff, attending funerals, helping sick ones, and all of that. But here, what we notice is that people are so busy, just our jobs take a big chunk of our time, getting to our jobs takes another chunk of time, and then all the activities, if you have family, all the extracurricular activities that you're engaged with. And so most people, it seems, just know their neighbor to wave at. But one of the things that we've been interested in trying is to seeing about doing activities for the children in the neighborhood. So we start what we call virtues classes. And basically what it is Baha'is can organize the class, talk to the parents in the neighborhood and say, we'd like to start a virtues class in the community. And it's one afternoon a week, and the kids get together for a couple of hours and discuss virtues and try to do projects, service projects in the community, visit someone who's sick in the community, in the neighborhood, and little service projects, clean up the neighborhood.
Shovel snow. Did they shovel snow?
They did. The kids shoveled snow in our neighborhood. What it is, it really, the children find themselves, there's something that we like to help people, but and children have almost an innate sense of that, and they found how much fun they had helping people. And so that activity is going on. We're also trying to get started in our neighborhood, an activity for what we call junior youth. These are kids between 12 and 15 and often overlooked a lot in our society. And they're not children, and they're not young adults quite yet. And they have a tremendous potential. And they have a lot of unique characteristics. One is that they're really questioning the world, have questions about everything. But they don't always have people they can go to get answers about things or even feel comfortable asking questions about. At the same time that they're questioning the world, they're also very conscious of what others in their age group are doing and how they're dressing and how they're talking and what they're doing. And oftentimes that larger peer group is kind of rudderless. Modern advertising is really focusing in on these kids and telling them how they should look, how they should think, what they should listen to. I like to think of the advertising world as a bit like the funny house mirrors. They hold up these really funny, you look at the fun house mirrors and you look extra thin or extra wide or wavy. And these kids are thinking, oh, that's what I should look like. And then they try to make themselves look like something. So what we try to do with the junior youth group is to kind of hold up a different mirror, a mirror of who they really are, and let them see what their potentials are. And again, it's organized around service, around finding out who they are. And it's mentored by an older youth, just a little bit older than they, so that it's like a big brother, big sister, who they can learn to have confidence in and ask those questions they may be uncomfortable asking their parents about. And so it allows them to create kind of a separate peer group that allows them to explore reality and the world they live in.
It seems to me that sometimes our youth are not, there's not enough expected of them. They're treated like children far too long.
Absolutely.
And I do know that in other countries, children are given a lot more responsibility, given credit for thinking, for having a mind of their own at younger ages. I wonder if it's fair to say from kind of what you've said here is that the Baha'i faith is a lot about practical application, more so than just sitting somewhere meditating or praying or whatever. It's more about actually getting out and drawing people to you by actually being there for people.
Right. Absolutely. We talk about walking the spiritual path with practical feet. And that the highest aspiration a Baha'i can have is to see what talents they have inside and dedicate those to the service of humanity. And then we look to see what are the conditions, how large is the Baha'i community, where it is, what are the resources there. And then, but the faith, the Baha'i faith isn't exclusive. And the idea is, as we start an activity in the community, involve the parents, get the parents helping with the classes, and then we can have more and more activities.
And if people become involved and do things with you, but then they decide that they actually don't want to become a Baha'i, but
no
that's
problem.
Okay. They can
absolutely.
Still be involved. They aren't shunned or...
Yeah. You know, one of the things about the Baha'i faith is that we absolutely believe in all religions. For us, religion is a bit like a school in that you have different grade levels. And if we think of the grade levels as representing humanity's history, there's been teachers all through man's history that have brought about religion. And Baha'is absolutely feel that this is one long chain. And so for us, we revere and love all these teachers. And for us, everyone is our brother. So whether someone is a Baha'i or not really isn't of any importance.
Well, you mentioned history, and I'd like to have you address a little bit the historical path that Baha'i's taken from the beginning, back in Iran, and some of the revolutions that have gone on and political leaders. I know there's been some real persecution and rebellion and growth and the different stages of Iran. I mean, people who have studied the politics probably know some of that, but I know a lot of people have not and don't understand.
Yes. Well, as I mentioned, the Baha'i faith started in 1844. And from the very beginning, as it began to attract people to its teachings, it being seen as not part of Islam, once it was seen not as part of Islam, persecution began. The one that started the Baha'i faith, his name was the Bab, which meant the gate. He was actually executed by a firing squad. And then Baha'u'llah, who followed after him and advance the teachings further, was put in prison, banished to what was then, well, still is Baghdad, but that was the Turkish Empire then, from there to Adrianople or Erdin now, and then finally to a city called Acre in Haifa. And all the time, he was either in prison or in house arrest. And but the Baha'is in Iran have suffered persecution during the Shah of Iran from the 50s up until he was deposed. He was more forward-looking and was trying to advance things and actually looked to the teachings of the Baha'i faith to bring some modernity to Iran. And of course, this was all set back then with the revolution. And from while there was isolated persecution in different remote parts of Iran during that period, there was less persecution of the Baha'is. But once the Revolutionary Guard came in, the persecution of the Baha'is stepped up again. There were a number of executions, imprisonments. They disbanded all of the Baha'i leadership. Each Baha'i community elects its own what we call a local assembly. We don't have a priesthood, so that each local community every year elects 9 people without candidacy, just a direct vote. The 9 people that get the most votes then lead the community for the year. So it's our form of democracy. But they basically disbanded the local assemblies and the national assembly. And most recently, one of the things to understand, when there's religious law as the predominant law in a country, each religion within that country is allowed then to take care of its own personal matters. So marriage, divorce, funerals, births are all taken care of by the religious community. When they ban the Baha'is from functioning, then the Baha'is can no longer carry out marriages, births, funerals. And so they began persecuting the Baha'is by saying, your marriages are not legal, so you're living in sin, and began calling people that you were, you know, you're cohabitating with a prostitute, rather extreme things. And over these last 30 years, it has accelerated to the point where they've now, if a child says they're a Baha'i, they're kicked out of school, out of elementary school, out of high school, or the university. And Baha'is, one of our tenets is not to negate our faith. So we say we're Baha'is. And so basically the whole children are now, if it's, we don't have to say we're Baha'is when we go into school, but if they're asked, we will say we're Baha'is, and then the children are excluded from school.
I have to say I wasn't very schooled, even though I went to a lot of school for many years in Eastern politics, Iran. All I remember is there was a Shah, and then there was the Ayatollahs, and I don't know what part they play. And then what do we have now?
Well, basically, it's a you can call it a theocracy, in the sense that there is a president of Iran, but basically he's sanctioned by the ruling Ayatollah. So there's a kind of a board, if you like, a religious board, a religious commission that decides really what happens, and the president has some limited powers.
So the president's still controlled by the religious leaders.
That's right.
Leaders.
Yeah. There's a fiat right now, basically, this started about 5 years ago, to find out as much as you can about who's a Baha'i. And there was a letter 8 years ago talking about how to exterminate the Baha'i faith completely in Iran. What's interesting is, and this is something I learned about recently, that a sociologist was looking at the Baha'i community and wondering, how does it keep going?
That's what I was going to ask next.
And it's because it's very much a grassroots-based faith. It doesn't need the hierarchy. The hierarchy helps it work better. But really, each believer is empowered to take care of their activities, to work with others. And so things just keep going.
So you don't actually have to have a building, or
absolutely
you can have
not
a meeting place, but it can be in somebody's home or
absolutely
something like that.
So, yeah.
it's probably not as easy. Well, it wouldn't be as easy to target as a group, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But I have to ask that too. Why? I know people don't want to leave their homeland, but if you're going to be persecuted for just being who you are, it would make sense, I think, to leave. I mean, I don't know how big Iran is,
mm-hmm,
but can you get out of Iran?
Well, people can leave. For a long time, if many of the Baha'is, many Iranian Baha'is left immediately after the persecution started in the late 70s and immigrated all over the world, but they were never allowed to renew their passports, so they became refugees throughout the world. People can still come and go. It's just very iffy what's going to happen next. And the Baha'is want to stay. They have, they love their country. Yeah, and they want to work for us establishing a better world. What's interesting, this is another thing that came to us, and I learned about this recently, some other studies, and I believe it's by an English and French group that went to do some sociological research. They found that there's about, they estimated 900,000 people who now identify themselves as Baha'is who weren't Baha'is previously. Mm-hmm. And because of the principles of the faith and what they're seeing being done to the Baha'is, what's important is that the Baha'i community around the world is working with their governments, their national governments, to keep pressure on the Iranian government about the plight of the Baha'is. Mm-hmm. And so the Baha'is there in Iran feel, again, a duty to help their country by remaining there and working toward the betterment of the country.
But what can they do if they are they denied jobs and if the children are kicked out of school? I mean, it's certainly going to limit what one can do.
Well, it's interesting. The Baha'i community there organized their own schools. And the university that they created was an online university and was doing quite well and being supported by different Baha'i communities throughout the world. Even IU is helping a lot of the Baha'i university students do continuing education through distance through the IU program. But the government went into the headquarters of the university with their and confiscated all the computers, but it still keeps going. We keep looking for different ways to keep things going. The community is very united, and so they help each other.
Well, apparently there are some people who, you said that the people had been imprisoned, mm-hmm. and that there are currently, what is it, seven Baha'i leaders who have been imprisoned in Iran. Can you tell us about that? Are they in grave danger? What is the issue?
Well, they've been in prison for almost 2 years now. They were arrested, and the trial only finished in January, that they were being held without charges, basically, or they said charges would be waged against them, but basically they were imprisoned and charged with undermining Islam. But they were a committee, not an elected organization, just trying to keep the community affairs going. And the government learned about them and arrested them. This is the second time that committee has been arrested. There are two women and five men, and they're in one of the most notorious prisons in Tehran. And we believe their original sentence was 20 years. And again, for basically following their beliefs and trying to support their community, nothing to do with undermining the government or anything. One of the issues that is used against the Baha'is is that as Iran sees Israel as an enemy and the Baha'i Faith's world headquarters is in Israel, they charge the Baha'is with being spies for Israel, which is not the case at all. And if they hold children's classes, they're accused of holding irreligious classes and undercutting and undermining Islam. So those are the kind of charges that are brought up against them. But through the world outcry after the 20-year sentence, the government almost immediately reduced the term to 10 years, but is still outrageous. What's amazing is we received, the members are allowed to have communication once a month and visit a family member for 1 hour once a month. And this was about the two ladies in the ladies' part of the prison that basically they serve the inmates, and the inmates who are there for various crimes have adopted them and protect them and take care of them. And of course the prison doesn't like that, so now they've moved them into the death row area. And so just it, but again, the Baha'is, we we try to practice loving everyone and serving everyone and not condemning anyone and helping everyone. So they kind of light up the place.
Well, a couple of questions come to mind here. One, if there's something like 900,000 Baha'is now in Iran, why these seven people drew so much attention to themselves to be arrested and targeted?
Again, I guess because of being a national sort of trying to serve the community from a national level without being the structure before. But again, the government has decided it wants to eradicate. So whatever,
so they're starting with them because they're obvious or they're in the open.
And the persecution happens in any community. Desecration of Baha'i cemeteries. I mean, anything you can imagine. People with pensions, their pensions are being taken away. And things that we can relate to here with our pensions being undermined by financial shortcomings and our investments coming down to being a fraction of what we had before.
Well, we have to take another station break. When we come out, I see a lot of parallels in what you're talking about and some of the things that have been happening here. So we will talk a little bit more with Garth Pollack when we come back.
Support for WFHB comes from The Hidden Closet, now in Suite 105 of Fountain Square Mall, featuring eclectic gifts, exotic clothing, lingerie, art, and accessories. More information is available at 345-7717.
Welcome back to Interchange. I'm Helen Harrell. Thanks for sticking around with my conversation tonight with Garth Pollack. Right before station break, we were talking about seven Baha'i leaders who have been imprisoned in Iran, I guess for being who they are, for being more open about who they are. I have to think with 900,000, more or less, members of the Baha'i faith there, what does the government, the leadership, hope to achieve by imprisoning seven people?
Well, again, to stop it from being more organized. Now those 900,000 aren't really part of the community yet because the community is not allowed to function. So these are just people who identify themselves with it. And I think they're trying to stop more people becoming influenced by the Baha'i teachings.
But if 900,000 people are willing to say or identify with, are they going to put all those people out of work and kick all of them out of school? I mean, where does it stop?
Yeah, that's the challenge. Iran's one of the larger countries in that part of the Middle East. And so it's still, it would still only be a small percentage of the population. And it's not only the Baha'is that are persecuted, but the Baha'is are persecuted more severely. But Christians and Jews and Zoroastrians do not fare that well either. But they're considered, in terms of the religious tradition, as people of the book. And so they were supposed to be protected under Islam. The Baha'i faith being seen as a heretical offshoot, and it's not protected under the Quran.
Okay. All right. I guess that makes sense. I never understand these religious arguments, you know, that people believe what they want to believe and then somebody trying to control someone else. Now that you are in Bloomington, what does the Baha'i community here do in Bloomington? I know you are still also connected with a group called, what is it, Give Back to Africa?
Giving Back to Africa. Yeah, that was just something when we got back here and was sorting out what we were going to do, trying to find some volunteer activities. And Giving Back to Africa is a nonprofit organization founded here by Anna Marie and Jim Thompson. Anna Marie grew up in Congo, and she wanted to see how to give back, and they've created a board, and they asked me to serve on their board, and I'm very happy and proud to be part of that organization here. But as I was saying, the Baha'i community here in Bloomington is not a large community. It's about 50 of people who identify themselves as Baha'is, but lots of friends, a lot of supporters. And as I also mentioned, wherever there's at least 9 Baha'is, they can elect their local assembly. And so we have our local assembly here. And we have a Baha'i center that's kind of an information center, but also a community center. And it's over on the east side, just across the alley from Omara's shopping center, the grocery store, just next to Kinko's in the back. And that's where our center is. But as I said, a Baha'i see their highest purpose in serving others. And so Baha'is are encouraged to start these neighborhood and trying to serve the neighborhood and the community. So Baha'is are starting these Virtues Children's classes in their neighborhoods. We have one of our members has started this activity for the junior youth and has activities several nights a week at the Banneker Center for these 12 to 15-year-olds. And we also have an aspect of prayer and worship. So we try to have neighborhood prayer sessions. Again, it's interdenominational, and basically it's praying for the well-being of the community and those that might be ill and things. So those are some of the but these are all personal initiatives. And then as a community, we try to support different activities throughout the community.
Well, as you talk about community, I know that the Baha'i are for some reason like separate, apart. Do you, and you mentioned Baha'i cemeteries. Now, are there separate cemeteries in this country for Baha'is, or is that in Iran, for instance, where there's the theocracy? And
generally, it's in countries where each religion has its own cemetery. Okay. Now, here, Baha'is are buried in whatever.
Wherever. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know. Yeah. I wondered, when you talked about being peace-oriented, do you serve in the military?
Yes.
Or as conscientious objectors?
There's a conscientious objector and something between the full combatant. It's a conscientious participator. So we believe in supporting the laws of the land. And so when the draft was on, we could be drafted, and we would then, when we registered for the draft, we would register as conscientious participators. So we would end up serving as medics or cleric, doing clerical work or mortar pool work or whatever it was.
So are there any military Baha'is in Iran? I would think, do they have a category that you can be a conscientious participant?
I don't know. I actually don't know how that works at all. I would assume if they knew they were Baha'i, they wouldn't want them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It probably wouldn't suit the purpose, I guess.
But in many countries throughout the world where there isn't an option, it's quite a dilemma for Baha'is. Baha'is are told, you know, you would never take up arms against anyone. So if there's an obligatory military service, the Baha'is would have to serve and then appeal to the military organization that to be allowed to serve in non-combatant positions.
It seems like from what you're saying to me is that the Baha'i want to live in peace and harmony. That would be a goal, peace and harmony with everyone. And I can see where some philosophy, some religion, some whatever, that would not work. But what ways do you have to kind of try and bring people in, not to the Baha'i fold, but mm-hmm. just to be cooperative, agreeable, not hostile?
Again, I think at a number of different levels. One is to try to have conversations like this with people every day. So one of the things we talk about is trying to have significant and meaningful conversations about these principles. If I look at other parts of the world, for example, in Africa, where the advancement of women is not a high priority in most cultures, the Baha'i community works hard to advance women in their community and to have that dialogue in the communities where Baha'is are. So it's a matter of, one, not trying to be an exclusive religion, one that doesn't say you have to do this in order to participate with us. It's wide open, and we hope that as we try to live these principles, people are influenced by that and take that into their lives, whether they become Baha'is or not. That's not the primary concern. The Baha'i faith feels like it's a millennial faith in the sense that its goal, it feels that humanity's reached the point where world peace is possible. And so our founder said that's what Baha'is should work toward consciously, to take every opportunity there is for it.
When you talk about the promotion or acceptance of women, certainly, and the goal is for equality, and of course I have no argument with that whatsoever personally, but could you explain a little bit why Baha'is believe so strongly in women and the power of women? And
I'm not sure I can. I can say some things about it. But again, the idea that women are the first educator of mankind, still the women have children, and they're the first educators of children in predominantly throughout the world. So for a very practical reason, the education of women is very important for all of humanity, that having a better educational background and giving that to the children just takes all of humanity up another level. But when we think about human resources, and again, another practical look at things, roughly 50% are male and 50% are female in the world. And if we're not developing half the resources in the world, how could we imagine we would be able to go forward? An analogy that the Baha'i faith uses is that humanity is like a dove, and one wing is the male features and one is the female features. And if one wing isn't as strong as the other, the bird isn't going to fly. So there's some very practical things. But also, Baha'u'llah, our founder, said that there's no distinction. God makes no distinction in any way between men and women in their capacity, in their responsibilities.
I think that explains when you put it like that a civilization or a society cannot go forward without using all of its members equally. That makes sense. I think if you look at some of these countries, and I won't name any of them because I don't want to offend any people who love their country and aren't totally responsible for the way they are. They aren't going forward. They aren't progressing. In fact, they're fighting to stay in place.
Yeah, and one of the things that I can say is very interesting for me with our work in Africa, working with rural Baha'i communities, the 12 years we were there and working with education, we saw a definite shift in the Baha'i communities where they began having more educational activities, that oftentimes the local assembly was mostly men. Now, it's sometimes more women than men, sometimes more women than women, but it's not an issue. And even at the regional level, when we had a regional assembly elected, it was predominantly men, but now this year the women are the majority in that body. And so also at roles of coordinating activities within a region, now women are equal to the men. So we're seeing that when you, in a very short time, you can promote these ideals and bring them along as a program, quite quickly things can change.
That, you know, it makes sense. I wonder, it's kind of from a sociological point of view, some of the cultures you're talking about, some of the countries you're talking about, actually were matrilineal at one time, and they've become so opposite. And it looks like what the Baha'i faith community members are trying to do is maybe go back to that, you know, not go back regressively, mm-hmm. but
reinforce those positive things. Yeah, we believe that religion has had a tremendous influence throughout human history for the good, and that at some point where again, we feel that religion should be progressive, and that's why there have been different teachers. And that analogy of a school, you have a first grade, a second grade. Sometimes the third grade student, looking back at the first grade, says, well, my first grade teacher really didn't know that much because he could only teach me, or she could only teach me adding, subtraction. But my third grade teacher, we're learning multiplication and division and even some algebra. Of course, at the child at that perspective can't realize that all the teachers probably went to the same level of education and could teach them that, but the children weren't ready for it. Mm-hmm. And that's how we look at religion, that when the founders of religions came, they taught toward the capacity that the children or humanity had at that point and taught them what was needed for that stage of the development. Mm-hmm. And Baha'is believe that humanity collectively is reaching a level of maturity, and we really can establish the unity or the equality of men and women, a harmony between science and religion as they both work toward the betterment of humanity, world peace, beginning to manage the world problems. No longer are the problems limited to a national boundary. Ecology, pollution, climate, crime, all of these, health, they're all now international issues, and we're only going to be able to solve these problems internationally.
And coming together internationally.
Absolutely.
We have to look at one another as human beings. Where do you think the Baha'i will be in Iran in the near future? I mean, it looks like the whole Middle East is you know, just exploding, and all these countries, as reported in the news media, mm-hmm. they want to establish democracies. I'm not sure how that's going to all play out or what their definition of democracy is. But where do you see the Baha'i role in all this? I mean, and where do you think they're going to end up? Are they going to continue to be persecuted or have a stronger role?
It's very difficult to say. There was, again, that 30-year period where the Baha'is, the persecution of the Baha'is and the serious persecution almost was stopped. This movement, you see, one of the teachings of Baha'u'llah is that we should have representative governments, and there should be the freedom to vote. And Iran, for the most part, has a one-party system still. Even during the time of the Shah, there was one party, you could vote for it or not vote. And it's pretty much the same way. They allow opposition, but basically the religious commission manages everything. But it seems that democracy, and as what we're seeing happening in the Middle East now, democracy is becoming not something as elective. It seems to be what humanity wants. And whether it's going to happen easily or through great difficulty and sacrifice on the people fighting for democracy. As Baha'is, we can only hope that there'll be a swell toward real democracy in Iran as well, allowing people to vote for their leaders without the parties being manipulated by others. And that's what the Baha'is would hope for, and that hope religious tolerance would be part of whatever government that's more democratically established would be part of their platform as well.
Internationally, yeah. On an international scope.
But we would hope also that as the United States has done, it promotes religious tolerance and freedom and human rights everywhere, and that we hope the American government continues. Mrs. Clinton just introduced a bill recently that's condemning Iran for the treatment of the Baha'is. So we're very hopeful that this will, you know, the support from American leaders will continue to support the Baha'is in Iran that way.
Well, now that you've spent a great deal of your life traveling and living in other places, and you're sort of ensconced here in Bloomington, I imagine your kids have a way of holding you in one place when they establish friends and a community group. What do you want to do while you're living here? I don't know if you have plans to leave again at some point, but
it's definitely an option. But being here, We're fascinated in seeing about what we learned about building community in Africa and South America, whether we can try replicating this here and, you know, bring the neighborhoods alive again and getting to know each other, helping each other. In our neighborhood, for example, we've started the children's class, and there's a few single moms. And on snow days, they're working moms, too, and they had nowhere to turn the kids. So they asked if my wife could handle the kids. So basically on the snow days. So again, seeing how we help each other and see how we can maybe make this into a bit of a movement.
Well, I certainly hope that I know you're going to be taking care of the kids. That'll be a good thing. And I really appreciate you talking so openly and forthright on the show about what you've done and what your goals are, and certainly enlightened people about the Baha'i community, because I think it's one we don't hear a lot about. So I appreciate very much talking with you.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
And I've been talking with Garth Pollack from the Baha'i community. And this has been Interchange here on WFHB. I want to thank our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morris, and the executive producer is January Jones. Original theme music by Jamil Effiam. And now stay tuned for Stardust with Tillman coming up next on WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.